And our next producer is going to talk a little bit on that subject. Chris Barrett's a fourth-generation farmer from the Rawls area, where he grows cotton as well as some other cover crops that he mixes in. He's going to share a little bit of his experience with incorporating some new production practices into his system that he learned from some other area farmers. Like I said, Chris is from the Rawls area. He has a background in entomology and agronomy. And I welcome Chris up to the stage here.
Got to figure out what button does what here before I get started. Okay, as I said, my name is Chris Verrett. I'm a producer from the Rawls area in Crosby County between Rawls and the little community of Cone. If any of y'all may know of that, may have drove 75 or 80 miles an hour through there. It's kind of hard to miss. It's easy to miss when you're driving through, because there's not much there besides our shop and an old singing school. But this is just a visit or a talk about where we're at and where we're headed and where we've been and how we ended up there. And when we started down this journey to a little bit better soil health, a little bit better economical sustainability is what I'm going to visit with you about today. Let me start my timer so I don't go too long here. Oh, okay, perfect. This is an ever-evolving system is what we're looking at. And what we're doing now may not be perfect in, we know it won't be the same in 2 to 3 years, but this is where we're at, and this is how we ended up here. This deal really started for us in 2011, and if there's any, the producers in here and anybody who's just tangentially involved with agriculture knows, you know, 2011 was a pretty rough year, and really probably until we got to 19, because at least the benefit of 2011 was the insurance price was $1.23, and we didn't have that this year. But it was definitely as dry or probably drier than this year. And so coming off 11 really got me to thinking that we need to be figuring out and finding a way to try to insulate ourselves from some of those, whether it be changes in the market or the weather or factors out of our control. And so that got me to thinking. And in 2013, a farmer and a friend of mine now, R.N. Hopper and his dad, Ronnie Hopper, started putting on a no-till conference at their barn there in Petersburg, or north of Petersburg. And when I went to that, that changed my outlook on farming. It changed the direction of our farm. And I knew as soon as I left, I said, you know, this is what we have to be doing. There was no doubt in my mind that we couldn't keep doing it the same way. And so that's how we ended up on this path that we're on. As I said, I farm near Rawls, and I farm with my dad, Steve, and my uncle, Eddie. And we farm approximately 4,000 acres of cotton, multi-species covers, and cows. And those are all of those things pretty much serve to service the cows. And we're by no means a cow operation. We never have been, and still reluctant to do it now. When this journey to better soil health started and people told me that we need to be integrating animals into all of this, I wanted to be like an ostrich and stick my head in the sand and not believe it, because I'm not a livestock guy, and it scares me to death to have to think we're going to start maybe integrating some of this, and we are doing some of it. And so you can see my son here, Charlie. He's 2.5, and he's obsessed with Toy Story and Woody right now. And so he's officially the most qualified cowboy we have on our operation right now. So this is very much a learning experience for us. So why no-tilling covers? You know, how everybody around here in West Texas knows that when the wind blows and the dirt blows, the sky turns brown. And so that's kind of one of the first, I would say, no-brainers from a no-tilling cover standpoint. I don't know a single farmer who enjoys changing bearings on a sand fighter and being on that tractor all day, because the ground doesn't dry up enough to run a sand fighter on a Monday or Tuesday. It rains on a Wednesday or Thursday, and it's dry enough to run on a Saturday and Sunday is when it always seems like it's dry enough to run a sand fighter, anybody who's ever run one. And so that was a no-brainer of wanting to try to eliminate doing a bunch of that. From a less soil erosion standpoint, keeping the soil on the land where it needs to be, and just less work for us, wearing out equipment and beating ourselves up. So, second that we've seen is just a cost savings from a few different aspects. First one, you know, that's pretty obvious is a fuel savings just on equipment. We've seen up to, you know, on an average of 60 to even some years a 70% decrease in fuel use on our operation. You know, on ours, we're using approximately 14 to 15,000 gallons less of diesel fuel a year just because we're not putting the hours on the tractors that we used to. There was a tractor this last year. It was between the period of December and April. I didn't crank up a single tractor and take it to the field last year, other than to pull them in the barn to do annual service on them. And so we're in the process of trying to alleviate some of this equipment or trying to get some value out of it because we just don't need the vast amounts of this expensive equipment that we used to have. And so then even on top of the fuel savings, what you don't think about, or what we don't think about at the time because it's not a realized cost at the time, is what it costs to put an hour, a tack hour on this equipment. Anybody knows the expense of these tractors hasn't gone down any over time. It's vastly increased. And so you may own the tractor and have the fuel to run in it and can run it through the field, but it still costs you approximately $40 a tack hour to run that tractor. It may not be realized until you go to trade it in or sell it, but that's an expense at that time you may not realize. And so that's kind of a hidden savings that we've seen of less repair bills. When we're not running them, things aren't breaking, so we're not having to send it to the shop to be fixed all the time. And that wear and tear and tires and everything, grease, just goes all with that. Another benefit is employee burnout. And this is one I'd never really expected until we got into this deal. You know, just this system of, like I said, it goes hand in hand with the, you know, not having to have employees out there working on Saturday and Sunday and scratching cotton, replanting a bunch of cotton, and running sand fighters over all this stuff. And, you know, the labor pool or qualified labor pool in this part of the world is going about the same direction as our aquifers are. You know, finding qualified labor, good qualified labor, especially to run this equipment now that is so much more technically complicated than what it used to be 20 years ago. It's hard to just turn anybody loose on a piece of 16 or 24 row equipment that's got GPS and variable rate equipment on it. You got to have somebody who's qualified to do all of that. And so finding these qualified employees is getting tougher and tougher. And when you do find them, holding on to them is as big a part of that as anything, too. And it's not like when it was 20 years ago, you know, when everybody, all your neighbors, were sand fighting and working 7 days a week and replanting and doing all of this. Now there's a few guys doing this, and they can look across the turn row and wonder to themselves, why are we working seven days a week when the guy across the road hadn't worked a Saturday all year long? And it's springtime, and they're in the middle of planting, or they're done planting. And that happened. That was kind of a case with one of my neighbors this year. He had 90% of his labor force quit in the middle planting this year. And I'm not saying we had anything to do with that, but I'm saying his employees can look across the road and say we hadn't had to work a Saturday replanting because all our cotton was in. We were done, and we weren't sand fighting anything. But they had replanted and sand fighted blocks, you know, they'd replanted blocks three times at that point and had sand fought all of them and scratched them relentlessly. And so, you know, this is just a fact of life going forward. And so being able to keep and retain good employees has been another great benefit that I didn't foresee to begin with of this system. Did I mash something I wasn't supposed to? There we go. Water infiltration or... just less, you know, this goes with the first slide, kind of erosion, not wind erosion, but water erosion. Water erosion and better water infiltration. These pictures here were taken in September this year, around the 20th, west of Cone. I think we had probably 2 to 2.5 inches of rain over the course of a few hours. And you can see on the top right one there, that's a picture of a highway. And I don't know if you can see in the center, there's the yellow stripe. And so you can see it's already covered up the shoulder and the white stripe and see how much of this soil has moved out of this guy's field. And you can see what the erosion looks like because it was just a bare blank field. And that used to be our reality too, is every time we got a rain, we couldn't hold on to it. You know, we're doing good if we can infiltrate, you know, half an inch per hour on this stuff maybe, and we get two and a half inches of rain. The Lord blesses us with that. We run it off into the ditch, and then now it's time to fire up the dirt mover, you know, later in the winter, because we got to fix all of this or go to plowing. And you get stuck in that cycle of, I got to plow and I got to move dirt and I got to do this because we're not holding our ground together and we're not protecting it. And the picture on the top left is my field directly across the highway from this guy. And you can see, or just imagine, I'm not saying there was no water that ran out of this field, but it was a heck of a lot less than what my neighbor had. And I've got a heck of a lot less dirt work to do and smoothing up to do than what my neighbor did. And we can slow down those 2.5 inches of rain with our covers on that ground, slow that impact down, and it's not beating up that top layer of soil and taking it all off into the Ply Lake, along with our nutrients. Helping collect unruly precipitation, as well as when we get some of this rain at 2.5 inches, get it fast, whether it may be blowing sideways, or it's in the form of snow, or it's in the form of ice. And as anybody out here knows, we don't get any wind in the, you know, in West Texas in the spring or the fall. When we get our rain and get our precipitation, it's usually coming in sideways. And if we can have something sticking up there like a vertical cover, helping grab some of this stuff the best we can, preventing big drifts, at least we can hold it the best we can, and that stuff can just percolate slowly into the soil. Said we're seeing less evaporation when we can have these covers on the ground. Once we get that precipitation, get that snow and get that moisture, we hold it on the ground. It's amazing how much darker and how much wetter it will stay, you know, especially in a dormant cover. We see this stuff, how much wetter it will stay and how much more we can hold on to that from less evaporation than what I can in my bare fields or my neighbor's fields. And so we can keep that ground cooler and have less evaporation. And most of the time, you know, we have maybe a little issue at planting. We'll visit about that, about some cooler soils. But 99% of the time, we'd like our soils to be a lot cooler. So we're not cooking out all the biology in the top 6 inches of that ground, the most important part. On a hot day, when it gets hot in West Texas, we can have 120, 130 degree surface temperatures. You know, we're cooking everything out of these things. And so we need to be having a mat of trash or a mat of armor, like what this soil and this native prairie wanted to be. You know, when you walk out in some of this prairie grass or some, you know, semi or what's close to native, you know, it always has a mat of trash constantly on the top. And that's what this stuff wants to be. It wants to be protected from having the sun beating down on it all the time. A good, healthy soil shouldn't have a crust on the top of it. And if we can keep it covered, we can help it accomplish some of that. So this is what we're seeing, and this is what we'll talk about, a little bit of the cooler soils at planting and some of this. But these are some of the pictures we've seen. You know, we're seeing less compaction and a better seed bed. But I've also never seen so many earthworms in my entire life since I stopped plowing this ground. It used to be when we were bedding up and listing all this stuff, I couldn't put together 2 earthworms on an entire 4,000-acre operation. And now I can't get them out of the way when I'm trying to find my cottonseed, checking behind the planter. I mean, they're everywhere, which to me is a good thing. I like having them out there. They're helping decompose and break down some of that trash in that cover, and they're an integral part of the nutrient cycle, as well as some of the fungus we're trying to promote in there and trying to get this stuff cycling like it should be. And so we're seeing positive signs of things showing back up like this. But as we talked about earlier, you know, the cooler soils, and that's what I get asked a question a lot about a lot of times is your ground so much cooler, is that giving you a problem? Well, there's no doubt we may have to wait until planting conditions get right, and we may have to wait an extra week to go to planting. But I think we've got a few factors that help mitigate maybe a little bit cooler start, you know, where we have a nice firm seed bed. Anybody who's planted behind a rod or even a strip till and some of that, you can have some mealy ground, you know. And if you get a big rain, you're worried, well, maybe my seed depth is going to drop way down on me. When we stop plowing this ground, we have a nice firm seed bed to put that stuff in, and much denser moisture bed. I lose a lot less sleep about worrying about my cottonseed drying out than what I used to. You know, plant behind a rod, as good as it can be, that hot wind blows when you go to planting, and that generally, you know, that looser ground that's got more air mixed in it, it's going to dry out quicker. I don't have near as much of the seed dry out as what I used to. So that's one factor. I think we have a better seed planting, a better seed bed for it to go into, be a little bit firmer. We don't have the crusting issues we used to, you know. We don't have to worry about running a gang hoe, which would be kind of hard in all the cover we have, but we don't have to worry about it. Our soils have mellowed a lot. Crusting is no longer our problem where we keep this ground covered. So emergence is easier on these tiny cotton plants that are looking for a place to die from the time you plant them. And so we don't need any more obstacles for them to try to get out of their ground. Our soils have mellowed. And then when those little cotton plants that are looking for somewhere to die, when they do come up, we're giving them less excuse of a place to die because we're protecting them with some horizontal cover on the ground, kind of protecting the soil, and trying to have as much vertical cover as we can. Because once again, that's the time of the year that the wind's blowing around. So this tiny succulent cotyledon is sticking its head out of the ground, and then the hot wind's beating it up back and forth and gets the sore shin on it. And so my experience has been, in the few years we've planted covers, is my cotton emergence is most uniform, and my cotton is the healthiest and my heaviest stands a cover. The cool soils haven't bothered me so far from the standpoint of, I think we're gaining back, or we can overcome what little we may have to back off on a little bit of cooler soil with a lot of these other things where we can protect it. And that cotton plant isn't having to regenerate leaves that have been tore up. And so I think we can overcome a lot of that with some of this. Our rotational sequence, how we've been doing this and why. Pretty much all of our stuff is cut in half. Said we're primarily cotton, and then we have covers and trying to do a little grazing if we can, but it's all pretty much to service the cotton crop. And so we'll start on a place, our dry land or irrigated, everything is cut in half. We plant a cotton crop, plant a wheat or plant a rye crop, then we plant a cover that winter kills, and we plant cotton back into it. And we're doing that primarily we're trying to move our cover crop's moisture usage as far away from our cash crop as we can, so we can have most of the winter to try to regenerate some, get some of that moisture in the top foot of that ground, so we can have good planting conditions. Okay. So we can have those good planting conditions and try to, you know, okay, so then we get to drilling rye behind the cotton stalks. We get our cotton out with a picker or the stripper, and we're coming in directly behind it with a drill. We're not cultivating. We're not plowing. I mean, since we're no-till, we're doing as little. I mean, we're just running the drill straight behind it. We're not cutting any stalks. And, you know, wheat or rye in this area wants to be planted the September 7th to the 10th is when it wants to be planted. And us as cotton farmers always like to plant it in December and January and then wonder why our wheat yields are so terrible, you know. And so planting this stuff in as timely a manner as possible is very important. And that's also why we've moved to rye instead of wheat on all of this stuff. You know, the old joke is that somebody could give you as much wheat seed as you need, and in 5 years you won't have enough to plant the ground if you caught every bit of it. You know, and any farmer in here knows that trying to be any kind of dry land and an irrigated isn't hardly much better. Trying to be a wheat and a cotton farmer together don't work real well if you're trying to take grain to the elevator, that is. Growing it for stubble and biomass is a whole different deal. And that's what we realized with some of this and why we've switched 100% to rye on all of our operation, annual ryegrass, instead of any wheat. Because, you know, we can figure up, in our best year, maybe 20 or 30 bushels worth of wheat. And on average, I mean, some years we're not harvesting anything. And so I was figuring maybe 5 to 10 bushels is what we can count on harvesting every year. Boy, that's, you know, setting the world on fire, isn't it? You know, trying to harvest a 10-bushel wheat crop every year. So we've switched to rye because rye grows so much more above-ground biomass and below-ground root mass. It grows, at least will produce a lot more biomass, even on poor soils, some hillsides, you know, some lake bottoms, you know, some heavier ground. It tends to do better. It's just a hardier crop. And so we're harvesting enough or keeping enough if we grow enough to try to save for our own seed, you know, for our own use. But we don't generally harvest the bulk of our stuff. We've also started mixing in some radishes with some of this on our rye to try to have the same theory on our summer covers. We're trying to have a diversity of roots in that winter cover as well, in our rye cover. Try to help break up some of that compaction. That's a new thing we've started this year, and so far it looks good. So I think we're going to continue to do that. And you see Charlie, my rye helper, there. We're loading a trailer out. And so, like I said, either we harvest it if we think it's good enough to combine, save for our own seed. If not, then we'll plant straight into it with a drill. And we're planting multi-species covers is what we're planting. And this is a 10-way mix. And this is an ever-evolving deal on you know, on what you want it to be and what your needs are. You know, our needs are kind of, you know, multifaceted in that sense that we have to have good cover to cover the ground, and we want to provide enough cover for that cotton crop the next year, but also kind of thinking of maybe what's a good grazing ration for some of this stuff. And most, a lot of times that stuff overlaps and kind of goes hand in hand. But, you know, having a multi-species deal is we're also trying to mimic what this ground wants to be, what this prairie ground wants to be. And despite what we may think or what some of our CRP looks like, all of this ground doesn't want to be just all buffalo grass and side oats grandma. That's not what it was, or not, you know, what I've been told or what I have researched. It's like all this stuff. There was a multitude of species out there. And so we're trying to include some diversity in some of this, some diversity from a root standpoint, a diversity from a shoot and an above ground standpoint, and also a diversity from a carbon to nitrogen ratio standpoint, which helps on some of this, because when you're building all this biomass on top, we need for somewhere for it to go, because I'm not going to bale it and haul it off. We can graze it, because we can get the benefit of the cows doing it. I don't have to pay somebody to bale it and haul it away, and I can get the cows to cycle it. But we need this stuff, and when you have a diversity of carbon and nitrogen ratio plants on the top side of this stuff, they can break down and degrade earlier and release some of that nitrogen back that they've scavenged in order for some of your higher carbon and nitrogen ratio plants, like your sorghum Sudan and your millets. And so those can keep kind of working and turning, so we don't have some of this trash. We don't want it left over 2 to 3 years from now, because that's mean we're not doing a very good job of cycling it. And so there's kind of a bunch of different reasons for having some of this. You know, this is the mix we have. It's pretty heavy on sorghum Sudan for a couple of reasons. I mean, it's a great great host or promoter of mycorrhizal fungi, which we're trying to get going in the soil and get a more fungal dominant soil and try to get a more fungal bacterial balance. But the big part of sorghum Sudan out here is it grows so much biomass, and it's the most drought hardy of the grasses that I've put in there so far, and will hang out and will wait on a rain, which is important when you're planting this stuff in June and taking it all the way up to a freeze. As y'all know, the summer is our driest period, and I've got some pictures here we'll look at and see just how dry some of this stuff will get, but can still hang on if we have a diversity of species in some of this stuff. And so, I mean, you can see the list up there, pearl millet and a bunch of different types of millet, and sorghum Sudan, and then we've got our legume in there. We've got some sun hemp and some clover. I didn't see much clover in this mix, and so we may reevaluate and try to get another legume in there, maybe some kind of bean or pea, I think might tend to do a little bit better. But the sun hemp did really well this year, and then a couple of a radish rape and some turnips for our brassica family. See if this will play. And this is us just planting into some rye that wasn't harvested, some standing cereal rye. And this is just a regular box drill. I mean, it's not a no-till drill. We hadn't done anything to this, but just plant right into it. We mix everything together and put it in the box. It doesn't separate out. That's the thing people wonder a lot of times. It plants just fine. It plants even. I wouldn't want to put it in the drill and rode it for 150 miles, but filling it up at the shop and going to the field, it's not a problem. This is a deal here. This is on one specific field I've got a few pictures of we'll go through and just kind of show you the progression of going through this rye and going through cover and then till winter kill, and just kind of look at it as we go along. This is a field here of rye, and it was one that I'd originally planted on. It's before we had some winter moisture, and I'd planned on watering it a little bit so I can make sure I had enough seed production for myself for next year. So I spent a little time watering it. And you can see on this pivot, it's a little shorter here on the outside, but I don't know if you can see in the second tower up there, you can't see the tire. And those are 38-inch tall plastic tires, so they're fairly tall tires, and the rye was over the top of that and was covering it up. So it's a pretty, you know, I'm just guessing. I haven't grown much rye or irrigated rye, but I figured if it did 30 bushels, it'd probably be doing pretty well. Some of the dryland stuff we cut later was 15, so I figured if this irrigated did 30, probably be doing pretty good. But the other thing I learned about rye this year is that irrigating is difficult because it gets so tall and wants to lodge. And so I put some water on this stuff, and then we had some weather shortly after this picture was taken, and about half of it fell over. And so harvesting it wasn't much of an option after that. Both of the two pivots that I watered ended up falling over, and I didn't end up harvesting any of them. I just ended up harvesting a bunch of dryland rye, which was fine, and it worked out. But I've about learned my lesson on irrigating rye. I think I'm just going to plant it, and it'll do what it'll do, and we can gather enough from that. But anyway, it fell over. So once we got done with cotton planting, we come through and we plant it into this. And you see, this is a little heavier cover than what we had before, but same setup. And we just planted directly into this stuff. And this is the first block of cover we planted. Like I said, as soon as we got done with our cotton planting, we started on our cover. And you see there, a bunch of it's fell. You see how much of it's standing, how many heads are standing up there. Not much of it. And it doesn't really look like we're doing much either. It just looks like we're kind of driving through it. You wouldn't think you'd be planting anything into that, but it is. And where we got it planted a little bit earlier, we had some rain and had good seed-to-soil contact. That was the 15th, and here's the 24th. I tell you, that was a beautiful sight, having that much cover on top of it and having stuff growing through it. Here it is a few weeks later. You can see it's also pretty amazing. We haven't done anything else to this, and how much that rye continued to fall over and deteriorate, you know, and lay down on the ground from what it was when it was standing up just a few weeks ago. And this is why I'll talk about later. I don't think we can grow enough cover in an arid environment if you're not going to be irrigating it or super limited irrigation, which this is, all this cover is pretty much just on its own. We may make a pass with a pivot if we can, but this one didn't need it because we had good soil moisture when we planted. But I haven't been able to grow too much cover yet for this system. Here's a little bit later, you can start to see we still have a great mat of trash on the bottom. You see some of the brassicas there on the bottom left coming through, but it's primarily the millets and the sorghum Sudans. And some of the radishes are down below, and the sun hemp is a little bit slower coming on. The third, this is probably this is the last picture before. We hadn't had really any significant rain up to this point in time. And you see this cover's doing good. It's hanging on. It's still shorter than the pivot tires back there. So, I don't know. This is probably, a little over knee high or was on me probably. But it's still dry and still see it's still kind of hanging on. We get to the 17th, and here's the video here. You can see it's starting to roll up. Starting to get a little bit drier. Not looking as swift as what it was earlier in the year. But still got good cover on the ground from the rye we planted into. Here's what it looks like on the 29th. This is when it starts to get looking really bad. You can see it's even shrunk a little bit from where it was on the tires earlier. And the stuff's starting to look like a pineapple plantation. Like when corn gets real dry is what it always reminded me of. Leaves look real pointy and real sad. Looks like it's getting ready to combust. Just looking at it. Okay, and here we are the 23rd. That last one was taken August 29th. This is September 23rd. And I think I took the first one on the 23rd. I think we had that 2.5-inch rain we had talked about west of Cone. You know, we normally get us a rain sometime in September at some point in time. And this one come a little bit later. I think it was like the 22nd is when we got it. And the picture on the left, you can still see there's a tire in the top right of that picture on the left. So you can see where it is in relation to it. It's about halfway up on that 38-inch tire, about where the gearbox is on the pivot. And this picture on the right was taken a week later, and you can't see the tire anymore. That grew approximately 2 foot in a week's time after having 2 inches of rain on it and being dry for 2 months prior to that. And that's what I'm saying. So, having a multitude of different things in this mix, and you don't know what that's going to be. Everybody's operation could be different on what's going to be. And I'm not saying it has to be sorghum soon. That's just what we found can grow a lot of biomass quickly and hang on through a drought and still be able to try to grow some biomass before we get to a freeze. And this, I didn't take a picture. The next one is after it's been winter killed. But this picture here, this stuff went ahead and grew another foot after this. I should have got out and got a picture. But it grew about another foot before, our average first freeze date's the 31st October. And I should have got out. It was about 6 foot tall by the time it winter killed. And you can see what it looked like on November 19th, how much of it had laid over. But you can also see, after having a little bit of moisture, having all that rain, after we had this cover crop out here sucking moisture all winter long, or all summer long, a little bit of rain, and you can see what the insulating power of that cover is doing and what the top 6 inches of that soil look like, that it don't take much to get that back to where it needs to be. And then from here, I have all winter long to continue to catch some moisture as well. And like I said, that's why we like this system and this program is gives us time to grow covers, but it gives us time to replenish the water in those, because this system has to be able to work in a dry land and marginally irrigated program. This a system that just works on irrigated ground is a system that's not of much use to us. We know how to grow crops with a lot of irrigation water. We got to try to figure out how to do it profitably on dry land. It's in limited irrigation because that's my future as a farmer out here. And so this is what our planting setup looks like. So we've got all our cover now. And now we're thinking about going to put some cotton in the ground. We run case planters with a 16 row and an 8 row, and they're both set up exactly the same. It doesn't take as much from looking at that last picture. You can see this is taken in November. That's some pretty heavy cover. But we'll get to some pictures later to show you. You'll be surprised at how much that'll deteriorate by the time you get to April, May, and June the next year. And so we're running just some finger-style openers with a depth band on the front. And you can see it's got a pin adjust in there. We try to, if it's real wet, you got to run that pin and kind of hold them up. They'll try to move too much. You'll get too wet. But in most years, you can just let them float. And we're not trying to move a bunch of dirt. That's the other thing. When we have the fingers instead of like a shark tooth, we're not wanting to peel off a bunch of dirt. I'm not really wanting to peel off a bunch of cover. I'm wanting to try to leave that as covered as what I can to protect the crop from when it comes up. But if we for sure don't want to move any soil, because the more soil that you start to move, then you do run into bacon issues and you run into some of these other problems that we had before. So we want to leave that seed bed as undisturbed as possible. As one guy put it, I heard him say, had an analogy of that we want our planters to operate like a sowing machine and go in there with as little disturbance as possible and just open up that seed trench wide enough to drop a seed in, close it back up. We don't look like there's any disturbance left behind it or as little as what we can get away with. And so then on the back, instead of the traditional smooth vertical closing wheels, we've got spiked closing wheels. And that's simply just to make sure in a lot of heavy trash with the smooth closing wheels on a case planter, it'll tend to kind of push some of that trash. But even the spikes on there, it'll always keep turning and keeps flowing trash through the planter and doesn't ball up on you. So you can see nothing drastic to plant any of this stuff. Or, you know, most people could plant in way more trash with a stock planter than what they think they can. But I know it can be daunting if nobody's ever done it before. But it, as you can see, we didn't have to do a whole lot to this machine. This is what that field or a field similar to it looked like. This cover here, and I'll have a video of what it looks like here later. This cover here was 7-8 foot tall when it froze the prior year. And you can see what's left of this, mainly millet and sorghum Sudan cover when we're planting in it in May of this year. And you can also see on the right here, we've already made a pass. You know, we're moving a little bit of trash out of the way, but we're not trying to move any more than what we absolutely have to. As we see, you know, we're moving a little bit, but we're trying to not move a whole lot. And so that's what it looked like when we planted it. Here's that same field 9 days after planting. There on the left, and I think right after we planted this, we had a pretty heavy rain on it. And goes to show you, as I talked about earlier, we had that firm seed bed. You know, moisture wasn't an issue on this because we got a good rain on it. But we didn't have to worry about our seed washing away or falling out of the seed trench like it was when we were running a rod on a raised bed. And see, 28 days after, and you see what it looked like there on the right-hand side. And to prove that we did actually, I mean, this farm here, I think it ended up doing, it was 1,450, right under 1,500 pound cotton is what it made on a half a circle. So considering the year, that wasn't terrible. This farm usually in a normal year, we're about to bail off on all of our stuff this year, but in a normal year, this farm's generally a lot closer to 2,000 pounds. So even in this year, and with that emerging, which that stand there, this was about 3-bale cotton. And so as we visited about before, about, you know, I don't think we can grow enough of this cover, because you saw what it looked like from those two last pictures, what it looked like at planting time. Here's a video of what that farm looked like. Right, this was taken in September of 18, much like some of those Weidman pictures. And you can see the video here. I've got half cotton on one side, then my cover. You can see the brassicas there on the turn row. And this stuff here, this was still a month out from frost. And this stuff here put on another foot. This was probably my biggest I've ever had. It got about 8 foot tall. It was touching the supports on the bottom of the pivot. You couldn't see the pivot when you drove up unless you got to the center of the pivot and stood on it. This stuff was so tall. And so on the same farm, on March 7th there, you see what it looked like after I was out soil sampling on March and see what this place looked like. And then the 17th, see how much less there is. And post-harvest, that was probably taken in November sometime. So from March to November, you know, 8 or November, December, whenever they planted that, 8 months later, you can see what went to that without plowing it a single time. The only thing it had was a planter run through it and a drill. That's all we did to it. And you see how much of that ground is covered. I wish there was more cover out there. I think if you're doing good, there's probably 30% of the ground covered, maybe. You know, it wouldn't hurt my feelings if there was a little bit more. But it's surprising even to me, you know, at where this stuff goes. We don't have to plow this ground and cover it up to get this cover to go away. You know, the old ad, we got to bury it to try to make it where we can plant. You know, that's just not true. All we've been doing is hurting our infiltration. So if we'll leave this ground alone, it'll and plant it like it needs to be planted and try to have some of the multi-species in there where they can kind of make help break each other down. You know, it's amazing what this stuff will do left on its own. And that's why I don't think we can have enough. Or we can't. I haven't been able to grow enough yet. I've only been doing it for 2 or 3 years, but I hadn't been able to grow enough yet in an arid environment where we're not irrigating a bunch of the cover. And so this is what we're doing from our weed control standpoint. We're starting in January or February and coming out with a light rate of Weed Master and some Roundup to try to clean up really any volunteer rye in some of these fields where we're planting into some of this. We don't want our rye going too long and negating the fact that we're growing a summer cover. We want it to be try to build some moisture over the winter. Then we'll come back in April with a higher dose of Weed Master and some Roundup trying to clean up Mayor's Tail and Kochia on all this stuff. And then behind the planter, and I don't... this has worked well for us, the staple and the Direx and the Paraquat, cleaning up. It's a little bit more expensive shot, but the staple's been is a really good chemical and has worked really well for us. That I believe, is the most important on whether it's your conventional tillage or no-till. The spraying behind the planter, I think a lot of guys forego, is the most important shot that we can have, because I've missed a few of my sprayings with this one before, and even where I had some dicamba cotton. You can't clean it up with 2 or 3 post-emergence applications once you get resistant, careless weeds. And so the most important shot I think we can do as producers and from a stewardability of some of these post-herbicides is make sure we're putting out a good dose of pre-emerge directly behind the planter. Early to mid-post, running dual or warrant, and then some Liberty and some Roundup, still trying to use the Liberty in there, trying to clean up any escape careless weeds. And then we're still doing a post-directed lay-by with a hood, and this is the shot I haven't been brave enough to stop doing yet. It's a kind of a pain from a labor standpoint. And as you get further into no-till and have this ground covered, our annual weed pressure is beginning to change. And we don't have near the careless weed pressure that we used to have. And I think we can pull this post-directed shot out, and it would save us the labor of doing some of that stuff. I hadn't been brave enough to do it yet because I'm deathly afraid of getting any Roundup resistant careless weeds started, but I may try it on a few fields this year. I think with the amount of cover that we're growing on some of this stuff now, I think we can start to do that. And you can also see, I got a picture here. We have a hooded spray rig, which has helped and worked really well for us. It helps protect our neighbors, which is good. From us drifting on them, but also helped. We did it out of self-preservation because we're growing half covers on all of this stuff and half cotton. You know, we don't need to be beating up on our own cover crop and doing damage to ourselves. And so this piece of equipment has been invaluable. If John Deere or Case would figure out how to put at least an 80-foot on a self-propelled spray rig, that's what I'd have. But if anybody's ever used one of these, we got a set of saddle tanks, 800-gallon saddle tanks, and they make some 1,000 gallons. But anybody's ever used one, it's hard to go back to having to, I mean, you still need to watch the wind and do a good job applicating, but this makes a poor applicator look like a really good applicator. You can put this thing on the ground, and it makes life pretty easy. And so it's just been too hard for me to get away from it. So justifying all that herbicide expense, we're growing primarily FiberMax varieties of cotton. And it's, we have to have all those pre's out there because, like I said, we're not using any of the dicambas or any of the Enlists over the top because the FiberMax varieties have just been too consistently high yielding and primarily high grading cotton for us, most consistently grading cotton over a variety of environmental conditions and years that we just can't get away from it. And it doesn't take very long for 2.5 or 5 cents a pound on a 1,500-pound irrigated circle or half circle to add up to a lot of money. Or even some of this stuff this year that I've heard about, some of these dicamba varieties, 10 cents off of what it is. You know, we're pretty consistently with these FiberMax varieties, pretty consistently loaning, you know, on average on all our stuff, 56 cents. And we'll have some 57-cent cotton. And so when you start talking about 10 cents off of that, you can pay for a lot of extra herbicide for $150 an acre, you know, on some of this stuff. And so we hadn't been able to get away from them yet and go to some of this, so we're still putting out a few more pre-emerge herbicides. And we're doing that too because, I mean, you know, cultivate isn't really an option with all the trash that we have and where we're no-till. And like I mentioned about the less annual weed pressure over time. So looking at this deal going forward, or, you know, when we talk about cutting, in our operation, we talk about cutting stuff in half, which is what you have to do, or, you know, if you're really going to grow a big cover on some of this no-till stuff and how it needs to be, you're going to have to rotate. You're going to have to do thirds or halves. You know, we like to have all of our cotton back on some good cover ground the next year. And when you tell people to start cutting things in half, the first thing you think is, well, half of my income is going to be cut in half. And, well, you know, it could be, but, you know, the thing we found out from this deal, it doesn't have to be, but it can, and you can see from this deal up here, we have an example. It doesn't have to be, but there's two sides to a budget or a cash flow statement, and the other big part of that we miss as farmers a lot is the outgo on all of this, and we're spending a lot less money producing the same cotton we were, you know, and doing with a lot less way to, you know, we're just spending a lot less to produce the same amount of cotton we were before, and so that's what's been the key to the success here. And so this just, and I know these numbers can be fudged and moved around, and everybody could differ. I'm sure everybody could argue with one number or two in this, and we could go either way on some of this. But I've left out a few like planting and harvesting because that's applicable to both systems. But for the things that matter here, you can see on a traditional, on what a lot of probably the pivots out here are set up for is around 2 gallons a minute and what you can averagely expect. And this is a little higher than the county average in Crosby County, 850-pound yield potential is what we can expect on a full circle on cotton after cotton every year. Or you can take that and you can double that and cut it in half and go to 4. And I don't think 1,500 pounds is out of the question on that. On our 4 gallon a minute stuff, we're generally closer to that 3.5 to 4 bell range. And my lighter water, my 2 to 3 gallon is generally closer to the 1,500 pound. And so I don't think I'm being unfair in some of this and some of the numbers. But you can see from up here what we're looking at and how some of this stuff can work when you go to breaking it down and looking at the numbers and how you don't have to grow twice as much because you're not spending twice as much on some of this is what guys think. And so I would just encourage everybody, and there's a good tool here on the bottom left, this South Plains Profit, .tamu.edu is an extension website. And it's a really good tool, not only for farmers look at their own, but how it relates on rented land. And you can enter this stuff in, and it shows the breakdown. You have every single input and what you're getting paid for and what the costs are. And you can put everything in. It'll show you what your share or what your profit is at the bottom and what a landowner's is, or just yours if it's owned land. And you can figure these spreadsheets a lot of different ways. And it's a great tool, not only just for farmers figuring out and knowing their own numbers, but if they ever got to go visit with a landowner and be able to show a landowner, this is what we need to be doing, or this is how we need to be thinking about things going forward in the future. It's a great tool for doing that. It's the same deal on a dry land comparison. And we used, you know, 120-60, a 400-pound yield potential on the 120 acres, which I think was being pretty generous compared to a county T yield. And then we're using 650 pounds. We've seen on average, you know, this year was kind of an outlier. We were anywhere from 250 to 350 pounds in our dry land. Like I said, all of our stuff was off. But in normal years when we planted behind this cover, we were from 500 to 700 pounds in our dry land cotton production is what we've been at. And so you can see it's the same thing. The number's just a little bit different. And with that, we'll move on to the questions portion. Before we get to that, I just want to make a quick plug. If anybody's interested in any of this, or there's going to be a no-till Texas symposium held at the Overton Hotel February 11th and 12th, and you can find more information at notilltexas.com if anybody's interested in stuff like this, or it's just a good community of people trying to look at some of this stuff a little bit different, much and be a good resource for some of that. It's in the third year. But anyway, with that, if anybody has any questions, I'll do my best to answer them now.
Tell me a little bit about how you
I didn't visit a whole about that, but right now our cattle operation, what we've been doing the past 2 years is once our crops winter kill, those big multi-species covers, once they winter kill, we try to get some cows on them starting in, generally November, December around that area is where I've got some cows now on a few blocks and run them for, I try to do it half and half. On the side, I'm have cotton on them. I graze them the least amount, and then I can run them on some rye that I planted behind cotton after that. But that's the way we've been doing it, but I don't like that as much. And we've been planting our covers in June, and they don't get enough size on them till they have to go all the way up to winter kill, all the way up to October, November, to get enough size to graze on them. And then we're also grazing a bunch of dead matter, too. There's a little bit of rye living in there. I don't like that as much. And so this next year, my plan is to try to start planting my covers before my cotton. Start planting it in April, as soon as it warms up enough to get my millet and my sorghum sowed in the ground warm enough to do that.
Excuse me.
And then I want to try to be grazing these cows in August, September, and October, when that cover is still green, is when I'd like to graze it. From a soil health standpoint, if we can graze a living plant, that injures that plant, and it makes it put out more root mass. If you're not eating too much of it up, if you're not eating more than half of the plant by weight from the top, then you're not injuring the root growth on these plants. And so that's what I'm going to try to move towards more, is grazing these covers when they're green. That also gets my cows off longer before my cotton crop the next year, so I don't have as much of the cow, you know, sometimes we know the overgrazing problems. Anybody's ever run cows and some of the hard ground give us time to recover from some of that. And so we're doing it more now in the winter, but I'd like to move it more towards the fall. And cow guys tell me that there's more of a demand probably in the fall than there is in the winter. Once pastures start to run out, permanent pasture starts to run out, that they're looking for some place to go. And if we had some cover in the late fall, I think that would suit that operation pretty well. I'm looking at wanting to, we have field net irrigation, or Lindsay field nets on all of our stuff. From a scheduling standpoint, doing some stuff with my crop consultant on some moisture probes and some of that. But, as far as scheduling or starting, we're not doing some of that, but we have the telemetry on the pivots. But I'd like to, that's the next step I'd like to look at, and I've seen Lloyd Author's presentation, and he's up next, and him and Jeff Miller have done a lot of good work that intrigues me on doing some variable rate irrigation on some of this stuff that I've seen. And we're trying to work on doing some field mapping, or some yield mapping this year with our picker when we went through, and try to use some of that data to start doing variable rate irrigation through these Lindsay field nets, which makes that pretty easy. So we're looking at that. Yes, sir. And I should be repeating these. Ask if the application behind the planter is a broadcast or a banded application. And it's a broadcast application. We were running on a bed or doing some more of that, and we were still plowing. We were doing banded applications. But now that we've gone to no-till and all this, and plowing isn't an option, every application we have is a broadcast application. Well, we're not plowing any middles. We're not doing any of that. So we're broadcasting all of this stuff behind the planter or any of the rest of it. Yes, sir. We're not applying any to the cover crop. We're hoping it goes out there and scavenges as much as what we can, left behind from the cotton crop, ideally, and tries to bring some of that to the top and puts it so it can break down. But on our cotton crop, we've gone to more of this last year. We didn't apply any phosphorus. Trying it out, my soil test showed that we didn't need any, and I was a little afraid of trying to run a chisel through all of that cover. So we just run about 40 units, it's a little over 200 pounds of ammonium sulfate is what we ran on that cover before we planted our cotton crop. And then the rest of our nitrogen, probably the other, 75%, went out through the pivot, in the form of 32-00 or some kind of urea. I'd like to start moving more towards maybe front loading a little bit more. I won't get too heavy, but they say the urea is a little bit harder on your soil biology than the ammonium sulfate is. So I'd like to try to start putting more out in the form of ammonium sulfate. Does that answer your question? Anybody else? Thank you all.